This is Professor Bush's torts class on November 6, 2008. This is podcast number 6 in room 308.
Money is on a plate at this end. Okay? Over here.
There you go. Good.
Make sure you take a fortune cookie on your way out. It has your exam grade written in it.
Vegetarian fried rice.
Hello. All right. In my class, God, Ben, I hate you so much right now. You just make it worse.
You're never going out, Andrew. You're staying home all day, all weekend.
I'm gonna cry.
No.
Get my text message.
You guys can have this book.
Thank you. put first, we're going to put the food in the back. So if you go on second, you just get up and take it, okay? You don't have to be, we're not taking a break. So when you get hungry, you want to have seconds, just get up and go and take the food off and come back to your seat, all right? Because we're not going to wait now for everybody to come up and get second. We just don't have enough time. But on the other hand, I might eat my food, otherwise they will waste.
What happened
to you?
I worked
22 hours.
Alright, looks like the sweet and sour is gone. Okay. Alright, there's one piece still on the table here if anybody wants it.
Oh, they didn't have enough to have service for this drink.
Very good.
Sorry. I made you. Who's the longest that ever
taken? There's no tamari on it.
Yeah.
No tamari sauce. No batter.
It does. And I don't need it myself. Very frustrating.
Good man, look at that.
There you go.
Okay, now this sweet and sour sauce is pretty good on that too.
There's no,
I don't think there's any gluten in there either if you're gluten intolerant.
Yuck. This is pretty disgusting over here. And we got some of these. All right, so you know what?
Just leave it like that here.
Okay. Everybody's doing this?
Yeah.
And let's, where shall we put this?
Back there in the left.
Yeah, well, let's going to disadvantage people on this side of the room, but that's not too bad.
Let's sneak around the back. So put that up there, okay? That's going to get up with you when you go. Can you do that? Or you just come back here again? Can you do it? And that one? Okay, hold on a second. Hold on.
Okay. This reminds me when I used to wait tables in college. Wow.
Okay,
everybody got? Now there's seconds in the back. There's more, a little bit more to fried rice back there.
And a little bit more of the noodles and chicken. And if you want to squeeze by the guys in the back row, I'm sure they will not mind. Right? Am I right? Back row? You'll make room for the squeezers? Okay, good. Very nice. Okay, we're not doing this again.
But it was worth a shot. Last time I did this, I had a smaller class. But I figured, what the heck, let's try.
But be sure to get up if you're hungry and get seconds, because honest, this food is just getting thrown in the garbage otherwise, and it ain't cheap.
All right. So, we started last night. So we're talking about this whole bunch of no duty arguments, defenses, the result of which, if they're successful, there's not going to be any trial, there's not going to be any questions asked.
Because that's the effect of a no duty defense, that it blocks the asking of questions. That's why defendants love this rule. And we said that there's several of them. The first one we said was no duty, and every one of them really has to be followed by a because. There should be no questions asked because.
And if there's no questions, it means there's no trial. You can't, once you start a trial, you're going to be asking questions.
So the first rule we said is we're not going to allow any questions to be asked because there was no defense. No actionable behavior. We said that means no risk-increasing behavior by any of the variant arguments that can be made to explain why there's no risk-increasing behavior. We're not going to go through that again now tonight. Then number two, we said there's another, and that's because that's necessary to protect individual autonomy and privacy from state intrusion, at least at some level. And then we said, secondly, there's another situation where there's no duty because there would be, if we were to ask any questions at all, a negative aggregate economic impact from permitting trials and questions and requiring people to defend, even though it might not lead to liability, but still people will have to show up. The defendants will have to show up, and the litigation costs alone will cause a rise in the cost of some essential public service or sector. So we saw that's the Strauss versus Bell Realty rule. That's the so-called public utility no-duty rule. That explains Mock versus Rensselaer, which is really what that case is about, despite Cardozo's, as the Eagles used to say, lying eyes. And, well, that's before your generation. I wouldn't expect you to know it. And also, however, that also helps to explain, to some extent, the third. Let's see, was there something else in here? The third rule that we looked at, right, which was the so-called, even though it's looked, it sort of has its own name, the social host no-duty rule, which is, at least in part, because we're worried about the negative economic impact on housing costs and the housing sector. So in part, it sort of relates back to economic costs, but also over here the because is, I should say in parenthesis, we have because, right? The because is economic costs to the housing sector, but also the Castro rule. What was that again? The social lubrication rule, right? But really, that is, we'll call that the sociability policy. The sociability policy.
Sometimes we care about people being able to have friendly social gatherings, and if those gatherings can't be effectively conducted without a little bit of friendly alcohol, and as a matter of fact, if we well, we'll see more of that. If that's one reason for not imposing a duty, because then people simply wouldn't have those parties. Another thing that might happen is that the parties would turn into fights. Every party would turn into a fight when the social host, realizing too late that he shouldn't have had alcohol there to begin with, now tries to stop people from drinking. So either there's not going to be any parties at all with alcohol, and that would be a loss to the sociability policy. I'm serious. This is what courts think about. Or there will be parties, and the parties will deteriorate into fights because hosts will get into fights with their guests
who want more to drink, and the host will feel obliged not to comply. Okay? And so that's a third no-duty argument that may arise in a particular kind of case. And then the fourth one we said was the so-called governmental immunity no-duty rule, which we just began to start talking about last night, that when a governmental entity acts in its governmental function, which we'll talk more about now, then you have no right to go to court and ask questions about it. And why is that? That's because of the separation of powers doctrine that is inherent in our government. That no branch of government can examine and trample on, can sit in judgment on another. Especially not the courts, because the courts, as is the title of a very famous book, is the weakest branch of government. What do we mean it's the weakest branch? A court doesn't have a constituency. It's not elected by anybody, at least not a federal court. Most state appellate courts also not. They're appointed by political officials. They have life terms. They're a somewhat anti-democratic institution, and therefore they don't have a lot of political clout. So if they start fights with the other branches of government, which are elected, which do have constituencies, which do have political strength, the courts are bound to lose. How many of you remember from your American history the very famous and somewhat shocking thing that happened with the U.S. Supreme Court under the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt? Anybody remember anything about that? Yes? Yeah? Court packing. And what was that all about?
He wanted to get the court to do exactly what he wants, so he threatened for every justice over the age of
70 to allow another one. Right. So, Franklin Delano, this is how we got the New Deal legislation that we still live by, passed. Because at that time in our history, you'll learn about this next year in con law, or whenever you get to con law, the doctrine was that courts could overturn legislation when the legislation put economic burdens on certain groups of citizens without due process of law. So that was a doctrine called economic due process. We don't have that anymore. But at the time of FDR, the Supreme Court used that doctrine to strike down the initial version of all the New Deal legislation that set up public works projects and set up public assistance programs and all of the other New Deal protective legislation, Social Security, everything. So Franklin Delano Roosevelt was about to take that, and therefore he said, well, you could do that, but I, together with my Congress, can pass a law saying that we can have more than 9 judges on the Supreme Court, and every time one of you retires, I'll appoint 2. And in fact, I may not even wait for you to retire. So now, instead of a 9-judge court in which I have only 3 that will vote in favor of my legislation, we'll have a 15-judge court in which 8 will vote in favor of my legislation. So that threat was itself enough to get the court to knuckle under and accept Roosevelt's legislation. Now, that was an example of how the executive branch sat in judgment on the judicial branch. But that's a lot more possible in terms of political power than vice versa. So courts are not going to be inclined to question the government, the other governmental branches, when those branches are exercising what's called their governmental function. And that's where we stopped last night. But there's a distinction, we said, and that distinction is discussed at the beginning of the Risk case on page 231, where the New York court distinguishes, this is a case involving the New York Police Department policy of not responding to 9/11 calls unless the intruder is actually on the premises. Now, why is that a governmental function? And this language is used at the on the top of page 231. You will see the second full paragraph. The court talks about the distinction between governmental activities, right? And they actually don't use the typical language thereafter. Governmental activities and those that
are basically normally conducted by private enterprise. Hang on a second. In the Cope case, which I also assigned for tonight on page 252, and that case I assigned you because it shows the same doctrine at the federal level. In federal courts, the government also can't be sued, except for the fact that under the Federal Tort Claims Act, which is what is discussed on page 251 in the note prior to Cope, the federal legislature, the Congress passed an act saying, you are allowed to sue us. We permit you to sue us when a governmental agent has harmed you. But if and only if, look at paragraph section 2680, section A on page 252, and this gives you the typical language, that any claim that is based upon an act or omission of a federal government employee ultimately, it says, will be actionable unless that act involved the exercise or performance or failure to exercise or perform, I'm sorry, this is what you can sue for, a discretionary action. The act, in other words, barring suit, does not apply if the agent being sued is exercising a discretionary function. And the Cope case discusses the meaning of a discretionary function and a governmental function. I'm getting you confused here. You can't sue for the exercise of a discretionary function. So the language here that the courts use is, I'm going to have to erase some of this now. This was the review, so that we can now start talking in earnest about the governmental immunity exception. The courts basically recognize two kind of governmental agent or entity actions. One is a so-called governmental, also known as a discretionary action, and the other is known as a proprietary, also known as a ministerial function. So what would be the classic distinction between them? The governmental or discretionary function is a governmental act that involves basically policy making, the exercise of policy making power, the power to create a policy which is in the discretion of the legislative or executive branch. A proprietary act is the action of a governmental employee in carrying out that policy. That's what it means, a proprietary. It's like a private actor, an employee of a private entity, and he is acting as a ministerial agent carrying out this policy. So in RIS, the establishment of the policy as to when they would send cops in response to a 9/11 call, that's a discretionary governmental function. And on the other hand, if the dispatcher took the call and the person said, the intruder is in my house, so it fell within the policy, but the dispatcher got the address wrong, or the cops went to the wrong house, or they got lost on the way, or their car broke down because it had been improperly maintained, all of those would be ministerial functions for which you could indeed sue the state. Okay? So it's only the governmental action for which the government is immune. Now, why is it immune for this governmental action? What's the nature of a discretionary or a governmental act such that you can't sue for it? And the answer is really given in the argument of the risk case. Why does the court say, the majority in risk, we're not going to allow the city to be sued for this kind of thing? And that this theme is carried through all of these cases. Why are we not going to examine essentially the way this policy was decided? Because that's what you would have to say. You would have to say, it's a stupid policy, right? So the discretionary act is basically setting a policy, right? The ministerial act is carrying out that policy. Some individual actor carrying out that policy. Why wouldn't we allow the questioning of the governmental policy, the setting of the when do we send a
When do we send an emergency unit out on 911 calls?
I just have a question about
you. You don't have an answer to my question? Normally, I require an answer first, and then I'll answer yours.
That's okay, though.
We'll make an exception in this case. What's your question?
I'm still confused about government, the government community. You're saying that...
I'm saying that the basic rule is you can sue for this kind of... for a screw-up which involves this kind of act, but not this one.
What
are examples? Let's give some examples of this, okay? Maybe it'll be clearer if we just talk about some specific examples. So, for example, in WIS, the act being complained of is the policy that was set. When do we send people out to answer 9/11 calls? In the case of Wiener versus Metropolitan Transportation Authority on page 236, note 3, which involved an assault in a subway station. And basically what is someone suing for there?
They're suing because there weren't enough cops allocated or assigned to that subway station.
There was no cop standing there to guard the subway station. And the court says, no, that's a governmental decision, that's a governmental function, and therefore you can't sue for that decision. Right? In the case of Pratt versus Robinson on page 238, note 7, another New York case.
A school district creates a school bus route. And on that route, there are a certain number of stops. Now, everybody who has ever sent their kid to school knows that one of the things the parents always are arguing for is more stops so that the bus doesn't let their kid off on the other side of a busy street. In Pratt, the bus map forced a child to cross a busy street, and one time when the mother didn't meet the kid crossed the street alone and got kicked. And the parents sued the district for not having enough bus stops or not placing them in appropriate places. Okay? And again, the court says that's a non-actionable decision. Now, why are all of those non-actionable? What do those all have in common?
And what's the rationale? What's the common rationale that the courts offered as to why we're not going to
force a trial on the city in any of these cases? Yeah?
Actions that basically question policies and policy decisions that were made by the legislature.
Or it's not the legislature, the school board, or the city council, or the mayor's office. Why aren't we going to question those, according to these opinions?
Because then you'd be crossing the mountains and it's their authority to change it themselves. You're going back to the whole separation of powers thing, I guess.
That's exactly right. How would it be a violation of... What would happen?
Let's put it this way. What are these courts worried about that they say might happen if we, in fact, cross that line? What would we then be doing? We, the courts. If we're going to question the decision of when to send cops out on emergency calls, how many cops to put in police stations and which ones, how many stops to put on a school bus route, then what are we basically going to be doing? You know?
Taking unelected officials and putting them in charge of the elected.
That's true. Forget about the political, the fight between the politicians. What are the judges now going to be doing? Let's go back one step.
When the city council, the school board, the local legislature made those policy decisions, how did they do it? What were they doing in making those decisions? Why didn't they make a shorter response time?
Their agenda is based on popular opinion. So basically, judges would be legislating from the bench.
It's not only based on popular opinion. It's based upon something that's even more demanding than popular opinion.
What is that? That's how much money you have, right? Why don't we send cops as soon as somebody calls? Because we don't have enough cops. Why don't we have more cops? Because we can't afford more cops. Or, let's put it differently, we can't afford more cops unless we fire the firefighters. And we can't have more cops, and we can't have more school bus stops unless we hire more school bus drivers, and we fire teachers. Right? So in other words, all of these
discretionary. These are all basically allocative functions. That's the language the opinions use.
So, for example, if you look at the bottom of third full paragraph on 231 in RIS, the court says, if we're going to get into this question, look at the language of that paragraph. The amount of protection that may be provided is limited by the resources of the community and by a considered legislative executive decision as to how those resources may be deployed.
So in other words, we've got to decide how much money, first of all, we've got to decide how much money can we burden our citizens with in terms of taxes. That's number one. That gives us a pot. That's not going to be an infinite pot. It's going to be limited. And then number two, how do we split up that limited pie between many competing critical public functions? That is what governments are supposed to be doing. That's the governmental function. And the court says there at the end, if we would get into this questioning these decisions, then the court would inevitably be determining how the limited police resources of the community should be allocated without predictable limits. You can't do that. You can't rewrite the budget of the police department or the school system or the fire department. That's not your function. And therefore, if that's what your case is asking us to do, then we can't help it. That's a policy decision. And the reason, you're right, there's a theoretical political reason, but you have to understand the practical reasons. The courts are saying, please, don't ask us to do that. We don't set the tax rate, and we don't make the budget and make the decisions about who should get what within that. We don't divide up the pie. We don't say how large the pie should be, and we don't say how it should be defined. And we can't. That's not our job. That's their job. That part of their job we don't question. That's the same logic if you look at the bottom of page 236 in the language of the Pratt, the Wiener case. That's the MTA police officer case on 236.03. At the end of that next last paragraph on the page, imposing a duty on the public authority would necessarily have an impact on utilization of the transit authority's resources. RIS made clear that allocation of police resources in protection is a legislative executive decision for which there is no liability. There is no liability. There's not even a right to have that decision questioned. And similarly, in Pratt v. Robinson, the court held also on page 238, note 7, that the district did not have to run a door-to-door service, a door-to-door bus service, and we can't tell them that they must because they may not have enough money to do it. And the way they set this bus stop, the bus stops up and the bus route up, that's up to them. So what could you possibly sue for? And by the way, you see these cases every day. What could you wind up suing the city for involving, let's say, a school bus incident? They left the kid on the bus. That's the kind of thing that shows up in the daily news every day. Some idiot driver left a 3-year-old on the bus all day because he didn't make sure all the kids were off the bus. Or the driver drops the kid off at the wrong bus stop. Okay? The route is correct. You can't challenge the route, but the driver made a mistake. That's called a proprietary or ministerial act. And for those kinds of acts of government employees, you can always bring a lawsuit, and then, because there's a duty to carry out the policies with reasonable care. So if there was negligence in carrying out the policy, for that you can sue. For the policy itself, you cannot sue. Now, sometimes it's not really very clear why is something a governmental act rather than a ministerial act. So, for example, in the Klinger case at the bottom of 236, in the same note with Wiener, there's a case involving somebody who winds up getting assaulted in a subway station where there was construction going on, and this is a little bit like Dovey Mannheimer, and somebody pulled this poor person behind some metal plates that had been stacked up against the wall of the subway and assaulted her. So the court says, well, this could be considered a proprietary act. In other words, where did they put those plates? And did they create an opportunity for someone to commit an assault, or a governmental act,
what should be done with that tunnel in which the person was dragged and raped while the subway was being reconstructed?
That was a policy decision. Can we afford to close that tunnel down, delay train service while people have to walk up and go over and get down the other side, or do we have to just do the best we can? That's a governmental decision. So the court says, in this case, we're going to decide
it was primarily a governmental act and not a proprietary act. There you see the two terms used side by side on the top of page 37. If it's a proprietary act, it's actionable. If it's a governmental policy decision, it's not. The decision not to close the tunnel and to leave the construction material there every day,
that was a resource allocation decision. Essentially, the question is it about allocating scarce resources, or is it about carrying out a policy properly or not?
Again, it's not always very clear. In the Cope case, the federal case on page 252, how many of you know Rock Creek Park in Washington, D.C.?
A beautiful park right in the middle of Washington, D.C., with a long, curvy road going through the park. And this case is about an
accident that was allegedly caused by the failure to design that road properly.
And the court holds that there were two things that were complained about in Cope. One was that the engineers had not banked the road properly.
They'd not, so that somebody went off the road at a speed where they shouldn't have if the road had the proper angle,
the proper, whatever you call that, the proper banking. The other complaint was that there weren't enough stop signs and they weren't placed in the right places on the road.
So the court said that the first thing was a governmental decision. How to design the road, how to design it in such a way that,
because if they had banked it more steeply, they would have had to knock down more trees, they would have had to stretch the road out.
Those decisions would have implicated the allocation of resources to the building of this road. On the other hand, putting up stop signs, that's something that was not a big deal and therefore should have been done properly, and that was a proprietary act. So these are not clear, absolutely crystal clear categories. But the bottom line is that you nevertheless have to try to get whatever your defendant did into the category of a ministerial act. Otherwise, there's no duty. Now, another point about this is that even if the act was a ministerial act, it doesn't always give you the right to sue. For some states, at least, including New York State, even if the action is a ministerial action, it sometimes may require more than just categorizing it as a ministerial action. It may require the creation of some sort of affirmative act on the part of the governmental official.
So you see cases
like Soricchetti on page 235, note B, after, and Cuffey after Riss. Both of these cases are basically similar to the warning cases that we saw earlier
in the section on feasance. Because you could say, well, wait a minute, those cases really weren't feasance cases because the no feasance defense really can't ever apply conceptually in a case against a governmental entity. Why? Because the whole purpose of that no duty defense is to protect individual autonomy. If we're talking about a governmental defendant, government agencies have no right to individual autonomy. They're not individuals. They're not even private businesses. So there is no autonomy interest on the part of a government agency. On the other hand, there is a separation of powers concern. And even if there is the act being complained of as a discretionary act, the question is, was there some requirement in the first place? So, for example, you call up and you ask the police to send somebody.
Let's say there is a policy that they should have sent somebody.
Or, even better, in these cases we're talking about,
there's no obligation whatsoever on the part of the police to warn somebody when someone's being released from jail. or to tell somebody when somebody's getting out of a lockup so that they can protect themselves. So there's no duty.
But if the what happens if the governmental official, in the absence of a duty, decides, okay, I'm going to call you up, makes a promise, I'm going to call you up and let you know.
So that's the calling itself has nothing to do with the policy, right? So there's a promise to call, and then, or somebody calls up 911, and the 911 operator says, okay, I'm going to send somebody right now, and then they don't carry through. They don't follow through on that promise. So that's clearly not a discretionary act. That's clearly an ordinary, this is also called an ordinary act, not a governmental, an ordinary act.
You should be able to sue for the failure to keep that promise. So the courts then, however, in New York State anyway,
go through a second analysis to say, was there
sufficient affirmative conduct or establishment of a special relationship to warrant holding the government official responsible for not following through on their promise, on their course of conduct. In other words, you may still not be allowed to sue because even though a promise was made, it wasn't made in a way that anybody who was reasonable would rely upon. So we have a kind of feasance argument being made about was there or was there not ministerial action, or was there just failure to act and confer a benefit? So, for example, in Florence v. Goldberg on the bottom of 237, that's a case where the school district decided to provide school crossing guards to substitute for the volunteer guards who normally watch the kids cross the street. Whenever one of them was sick, the police department would send a cop. One day, the guard was sick, and they didn't send a cop. A kid crossed the street, got hit, and the police department was sued. Was that a policy decision? Absolutely not. It was a ministerial decision. But the question is, since they didn't have to do that in the first place, why wasn't it simply a failure to confer a benefit? This is feasance, non-feasance language, right? Not having the guard come on the day of the accident wasn't misfeasance. It wasn't feasance at all. It simply was inaction, and therefore, according to the courts, that might be a non-actionable case, even though it's not setting a policy. It's doing a specific act. And the answer in that case was because they started to provide the guards, and therefore everybody counted on them. So it's very similar to the feasance, non-feasance distinction. So in other words, you got two hurdles to get into court. The first is to show that you're not talking about a governmental act, you're talking about an ordinary ministerial proprietary act. The second thing is to show that in that ministerial act itself, there was the equivalent of feasance on the part of the governmental official, not simply not getting involved at all. Only then do you have a right to bring a lawsuit. Yeah?
Does that
It has to be risk-increasing behavior. That's what feasance is. So the guard, the police department, when they started supplying substitute guards, from that moment on, right?
Always think of, when you think about RIB, always think about, from that moment on, you and me.
From that moment on, all the parents and children were at greater risk that someday their kid would be out there without a guard.
Because the normal guard didn't show up, and the police guard didn't show up, and the parent didn't show up because she was counting on the other two. That's called risk-increasing behavior. So basically what you got to show over here is there was some sort of risk-increasing behavior on the part of that individual government actor or that you're trying to sue. In our other examples, the police department, so let's take another example that distinguishes. The police department has a policy. You never drive over 50 miles an hour except in hot pursuit. That's a standard police department policy. They all have it. You never go in hot pursuit more than 50 miles an hour without sirens and flashes. Okay? So if you are hit by a police car in an intersection, right, with sirens and flashers, going through that intersection in hot pursuit and they smash right into you, you can't sue. Because they were carrying out the policy. And you may say that's a terrible policy to allow police cars to go 75 miles an hour in a crowded residential neighborhood no matter what they do.
But that's the policy. The policy is a hot pursuit policy, and that can't be questioned. On the other hand, if this cop was traveling at 75 with sirens and flashers, but there was no hot pursuit going on, was doing it to, you know, get to the scene of a crime where somebody had already been killed, but there wasn't anybody to catch. So therefore, he was violating that policy, right? For this, you could definitely sue. Now, that doesn't mean still that the cop will be held, the department will be held liable, because maybe he has some other good reason. But he's going to have to answer questions, right? About the policy, you can't ask questions. About the failure to carry out the policy properly, or some other inappropriate action on the part of the police officer, he was driving carelessly. You certainly can sue the city. So those are the major distinctions to be aware of in this area.
Okay? Not too complicated, really. It's just a question of how do you apply it to facts? And the answer is you do your best. Okay? All right. Now I want to go on to yet another, our fifth no-duty rule. Keep losing my eraser.
Where did it go this time? Somebody should be assigned to keep track of my eraser.
Oh, here it is.
Okay. The fifth no-duty rule that we're going to look at, which we adverted to earlier in part, is called the rules regarding so-called premises liability, also known as the liability or the duty of owners and occupiers of land.
Now, these cases are, these rules apply in a very particular situation.
Remember last night, somebody said something about, when did that come up, about the fireworks in the house?
What was that?
That was talking about, I was talking about the social host. Hello, that was your argument, right? Why shouldn't I be allowed to have my party and fill my guests with liquor and send them out? So I said, could you have fireworks, a fireworks show in your living room? And the answer was, no, you can't.
Why not? Because that will probably endanger your neighbors.
So what you're worried about there is an act that causes injury to someone outside of your premises, doing something on your property that causes injury to someone off of your property. That's not what premises liability is about. Premises liability is about injuries caused, generally speaking, not by an activity that you're conducting on your property, but by the condition of the property itself. An injury inflicted by a condition of the property, not to somebody outside, but to someone who has become a visitor on your property.
So the classic example of this would be someone who comes to your house in the middle of the winter and slips on your icy front walkway and falls down and injures themselves. That's a premises liability case. Or someone who comes into your house and starts to climb up the stairs to the second floor to go to the bathroom and falls through a defective stairway tread and injures their leg. Or falls off because the banister is loose and they fall right off onto the main floor.
All of those are injuries inflicted by a condition of your property. The icy walkway, the defective stair tread, the loose banister, on someone who is on your property. And that's what all of these cases and all these rules that we're now looking at apply to.
Now, these are not, in this area, there is really only in one area, and even then not 100%, such a thing as a no-duty rule.
So basically, we're not really talking about no duty, we're talking about limited duty
in the premises liability area. What does that mean? Well, let's look at the case, the first case, which is actually the majority rule, because in this area, there are two rules of law that are used in different jurisdictions. So, here, as in the proximate cause area, you have to be aware of the fact that there is more than one possible rule. What do we mean proximate cause? We saw that there are some jurisdictions in proximate cause that use only the Polemus rule,
There has got to be a superseding intervening cause, otherwise you don't get off the hook.
And there are other jurisdictions in which you can get off the hook either for that reason or if there's an unforeseeable occurrence, the wagon mount rule. So we have two different rules. On an exam, Professor Bush, which rule should we use on the exam? The answer is, on an exam, you should always assume that the rule has not yet been definitively established in the jurisdiction that you're operating in. And therefore, depending upon whose side you're on, the rule you use should be, in the first instance, the rule that's better for you. So you have to argue, in the first instance, I think the court should use the Polemus rule, right? Because I'm the defendant, and because I'm the plaintiff, and there's no superseding intervening cause. So I want to get to this guy, and if there's no superseding cause, I get him, because unforeseeably doesn't matter. So in the first instance, you use the rule that suits you best. However, you also try to have a backup argument, which says, even if the court uses the other rule, I still win, because this wasn't an unforeseeable occurrence. So you have to learn to argue in the alternative. I want Rule A because I win under Rule A, but even if I don't get Rule A and I have to have Rule B, here's how I win under Rule B too. Okay? That's what you always have to do on an exam when we are dealing with an issue where there are two rules, each valid in different jurisdictions. So this is, I think this is only the second area. We're going to have two more areas where we see this same phenomenon of different rules in different jurisdictions. So what's the first rule? First rule is what's called the traditional category system for dealing with premises liability. And it is exemplified in the case of Carter v. Kinney. What happened in Carter v. Kinney? And this is a classic. Both of these cases are classic premises liability rules. What happens in Carter v. Kinney? Something like I suggested to you, that the plaintiff, well, what does happen? Somebody tell me what happens at Carter v. Kinney. It's a sad story, right? Sad story. Relax. Enjoy your food. What happened at Carter v. Kinney?
A couple were supposed to have Bible study in their home, and the guy decided he was going to go. And I don't think he found out on the street, but he decided to go with himself.
So this is an icy. These are both cases. Carter v. Kinney is one. The other case we have, which is Hines v. Webster, they're both slip and fall cases on
icy walks on property.
So somebody's coming, slips on ice, falls, injures themselves, and sues.
In Carter v. Kinney, the guy who comes and slips and falls is coming for a Bible study class, right?
And therefore, as a result of the fact that he came, suppose he had been, wait, as a result of the fact he's come from a Bible study class,
therefore, the court says what? Because of that, he has nothing to complain about, right? He has no lawsuit. Why is that? There was an icy walk. It should have been cleared off. It wasn't salted. It wasn't cleaned. What kind of thing is that to invite somebody to your house or to open your house for Bible study and then not salt your sidewalk? And somebody falls down. It's foreseeable that someone will fall down, isn't it? Isn't that negligent in the wintertime? No, it's not. By the way, don't live in New York with that opinion. As a New Yorker, if you don't salt your walk and a dog slips on it, you're likely to get sick. You got to be out there while it's snowing, every hour, shoveling and salting. Otherwise, you're in trouble. Have a lot of heart attacks, but not do any slipping falls. But in Carter v. Kinney, the court says, no, this guy has no right to expect an ice-free walkway. Why? Because he is a what? He is what?
Lessee.
No, he's not a lessee.
A licensee.
Now, suppose he had been Mr. Kinney's accountant, who had come over to finalize his tax return. And he's filing a little late. It's December. What the heck, you know? Still, he's going to get it in eventually.
So he was an accountant coming over to finalize a tax return or go over a year-end audit. And he slipped on the walk and fell. What would this same court say? Why? Because
because then he would be considered an invitee. So the traditional rule of premises liability is we divide people up into three categories, and that's why we call it traditional categorical rule, right? The categories are invitee, licensee, and trespasser. And what's the difference between these three categories?
You're doing so well. Tell me what the difference is.
An invitee is someone who is the owner of the property and actually asks for his expectation.
Not necessarily. If I invite you over to play bridge, are you an invitee?
No.
What makes you an invitee? It's not my invitation. Don't get deluded by the words. It's a term of art. What makes you an invitee? Yeah.
Trying to receive a material benefit from the person.
Who is receiving a material benefit from whom?
The person you
invite,
you expect to receive a personal benefit.
Right. This is a person who is coming to confer on you some sort of material, commercial, pecuniary benefit. He's doing your taxes. He's fixing your toilet. He's teaching you French so you can go and enjoy France in the springtime. Whatever he's doing, you're getting a material benefit. Doesn't have to be, by the way, for actual money exchanged, but some sort of commercial, material, perhaps pecuniary, economic benefit. Anybody who comes on your property to confer a material economic benefit on you is an invitee. And by contrast, what's a licensee? A licensee is doing what? You're doing good now. It'll take over. Just come over and just drop by? So let's say the guy who breaks into your house to steal your watch, is that an invitee? No. You're not trying to get a material benefit. So the classic example of a licensee is a social guest. Right? Someone who's coming over is your guest, so you may well have invited them, or they may drop over, but you don't throw them out, you know? In other words, they're there with your permission, if not invitation. But they're there for a social reason, not a commercial reason. And on the other hand, there is a trespasser, right? Who is not a, and we could say that in some ways a commercial, an invitee is a business guest, as opposed to a social guest. A trespasser is not a guest at all. He's someone who is unwanted, and he's on your premises without permission. Right? So why are we dividing people up like this? Why are we dividing people up like this? Or what's the consequence? So therefore, okay, what difference does it make? The difference that it makes is that the duty owed is different to each one of these kinds of people. The duty that's owed to a trespasser, to start from the bottom up, from the least duty owed, but that's why we have to say it's none of these are a no-duty rule. That's why we're saying this is limited duties. Because you owe a limited duty to every single one of these kinds of people. You, to a trespasser, for example, you owe a duty to avoid willful and wanton misconduct and setting a trap. That's why I said the other day that it wouldn't be a good idea if you're a landlord to install a spring gun to shoot with a crossbow the first guy that breaks into your house, because that's called a trap. And you're not allowed to set a trap. You're not allowed to dig a pit, put stakes in it, put poison on the ends to get rid of those trespassers. We don't allow that. You owe trespassers a duty to avoid setting a trap and willful and wanton misconduct. What would that be? That would be like, you know that there is somebody who always comes and sleeps under your tree and drinks beer and throws the cans on the lawn. One day, you see, happens not to have slept it off yet, so you decide that would be a good day to mow the lawn with your John Deere mower. And you're not too careful about how you do it either. So he loses a foot. Okay? Not that you wanted to cut his foot off, you see, but that's called willful and wanton misconduct. You back your car out of the driveway, not bothering to see, is that guy still sleeping in the driveway where you always find him in the morning? You didn't intend to hit him, just happened to be there. That's called willful and wanton misconduct. It's like one step worse than recklessness. It's almost deliberate injury, right? You can't do that to to a trespasser, you have to avoid willful and wanton misconduct and setting traps. What about, by contrast, it's your accountant who came over? What is the duty that you owe to your accountant? Or the plumber? Joe the plumber? Rudy the plumber? Cindy the plumber? Or anybody the plumber? The answer is, you owe that person a full duty to act as a reasonable person in the maintenance of safe premises. So in other words, what does that practically mean? It means that if you're going to invite somebody over to your house as an invitee, a business guest, then you better know whether your stairs are safe or not. And if they're not, in other words, you have to discover dangerous defects in your property. And having discovered them, you have to take reasonable measures to fix them and make them reasonably safe. You probably can't even get by, although this is a question that's raised in the notes after Carter versus Kinney on page 199, note 6. You probably can't get by, for example, in Carter v. Kinney, if it had been the accountant. So you know what? I didn't have time to scrape and salt the walkway, so I put a sign up saying, "Watch out, icy walkway." Now my accountant is coming over, right? I know he's coming over. He's coming over my bed. I put up a sign saying, "Watch out or you'll fall and break your leg." So he gets to the end of my walk, right? What is he supposed to do? Take the sign and put it down and walk on the sign? He still has to walk on the thing, right? So simply warning him of the dangerous condition is probably not enough.
And that's the note about open and obvious dangers on page 199. For an invitee, it's not enough to warn that person.
What you have to do, you have a duty to make your premises reasonably safe. What does that mean? That's why I say RPS, reasonable person standard. What would a reasonable person have done to check the safety of the premises? That's what you should have done.
What would a reasonable person have done discovering a defect to fix that? That's what you should have done. How soon would they have done it? That's how soon you should have done it.
So this is basically just a standard, ordinary, full duty of reasonable care under all the circumstances. Now, that doesn't mean that sometimes you won't get off the hook because you found something, you didn't have time to fix it before somebody showed up. But you have to account for yourself completely and fully, okay? So that's one extreme to the other.
We'll come back and talk about details in a minute. What about a social guest? What about a social guest? What's the duty owed to a licensee?
It's not Joe the plumber, and it's not Tim the trespasser. It's Larry the loser who came over to drink a few and spend the evening. What's the duty you owe to Larry the loser?
Yeah?
Any danger which the owner is aware of?
Any danger? How is that a grammatical answer to my question?
What is your duty to Larry when he comes to hang out and drink beer with you?
To make your house safe of any danger that you're aware of before you
go? No. No, that is not the duty. You could be aware of the danger. By the way, you guys eating that food back there? Get up anytime you're hungry and go get some more food.
And by the way, if you need to take a break, you can get up and do that too. We're not stopping, okay? We had our break beforehand.
It's not really fair, right, to feed you and then not let you go to the bathroom, but you should probably take a 4-minute break, you know?
All right, so let's finish this one and we'll take a 4-minute break. What is the duty to Larry? The duty to Larry, which is expressed differently in different places.
As a matter of fact, in Carter v. Kinney, it is not explained very clearly. All of this is explained in Carter on the middle of page 196, right? And it says, the possessor owes licensee to make safe dangers of which the possessor is aware. That's why you said that, right? That's actually not the best statement to that rule. The best statement of that rule is found in the Hines case, ironically enough, in the middle of page 202, where the court says that if Hines was a licensee, then under the traditional rules, which Hines rejects, the county didn't willfully or wantonly act, nor, that in other words, it didn't, you know, fail his, if he had been a trespasser, it would have been okay. And nor did it fail to warn him of known hidden dangers. And that is traditionally the language of stating the duty to a licensee. The duty to a licensee is to warn the licensee of known hidden dangers. KHD, known hidden dangers.
Now, that's a rather odd phrase, isn't it? Known hidden dangers.
Isn't that an oxymoron?
Why isn't it an oxymoron? Anyway, what is an oxymoron? It's someone who didn't vote on Tuesday. No. Why isn't it an oxymoron, Mr. Leary?
Because me as a homeowner might still know that it's there, but the person visiting me might not see it.
Well, that's true. If you know it's there and he doesn't see it, then that's exactly the kind of thing you have to warn about. Okay? In other words, the known here refers to the homeowner. A danger that you know about. The hidden here refers to him. It's not open and obvious and observable by him. So what duty do you have to a licensee? You have the duty to warn him of dangers that you know about and that aren't going to be obvious to him. The icy walkway in Kinney, is it a known hidden danger? It's a known danger. I know it's icy, but it's not hidden from him, right? It's obvious that it's icy. The stair tread that suddenly breaks under the feet of my guest, is that a known hidden danger? It depends. Do I actually know that that stair is about to break? If so, then it's probably known to me and hidden from him, and I should warn him before he starts up the stairs. But if I don't actually know it, in other words, it seems to have been in good condition. I haven't, or maybe I haven't been on that stairway for a while. Maybe it's a stairway to the basement. And I haven't been down there. And now he goes down there, and the first time anybody knows that that tread is weak is when he falls through it. So in that case, I didn't have any duty to him at all, because that wasn't a danger that was known to me. You see the difference between the duty here and here? For an invitee, I have to know what's wrong with my house. Or at least I have to take reasonable steps. Before I have people come over, I have to take reasonable steps to make sure that my premises are safe, and then fix them. For a licensee, I don't have to do anything. If I leave my dirty socks in the middle of the floor, and you come over and trip on them, pow, right? You know they're there. If I don't leave my socks in the middle of the floor, but my floor has rotting wood in it, but I'm not aware of it because I don't go to that part of the room, and you come over and walk to that corner of the room and fall through the floor, I also don't owe you anything because I didn't know about it. So, tough on you. All I have is the duty to warn you of dangers that I know about. I'd have to find out about them, that I actually know about, and that you would not see for yourself. And then all I have is the duty to warn you about them, not to fix them. I don't have to fix them. I could say to you, watch out for the fifth stair. Watch out for the hole in that corner. Watch out for the icy walkway. Watch out for the pit bull. Watch out! That's all I have to say. And if I warn you, I have fulfilled my duty, because that's the only duty I have, besides not setting a trap. Okay? Let us take a short 4-minute bathroom break. And I mean short 4 minutes, because we wasted a lot of time with the Chinese food. If there's food in the back, and you're still hungry, and it's not too disgusting at this point, eat it up. If you need a new plate, I actually have some more plates. If you're 3 yards away and you want another plate, some more plates. And I have forks too for people getting seconds. I hear that's exactly what you would say. The risk is small, the cost is high, and they're not absolutely good. But here, I could say, yeah, well, he needs to fix it, but why? I didn't think I had to fix that. I mean, why? I just, I always know, I'm not going to fix my stairs. It's an expensive thing, and I haven't had time to get to it. So, I just put a little yellow circle on there so I know which step to avoid, and I have somebody over, I tell them. So, I don't have the duty to actually fix it, even if it would be very easy. And it's very dangerous when the way it is. All I have to do when you come over is say, watch out for the step that has the yellow circle on. That's what I can say.
Known hidden duty.
No, not known hidden duty. Known hidden danger.
Yeah, known hidden danger.
Yeah.
Could that also mean that you as a homeowner know could exist, but might not necessarily?
No. That you actually look. Young home? Apartment?
Yeah.
Okay. So, is there anything in your apartment that is dangerous that you know about?
No.
So there you go. You're home free. Have anybody over you want to play cards?
Well, this is not difficult.
Right? On the other hand, if you, like me, have stairs that come into the basement, it's a little bit rickety, then, or, you know, there's a ceiling tile that tends to fall down.
Right.
Don't call cable guy. Right. But if your friend comes over to watch cable, all you have to do is go over here. All you have to do is get on. When you go down that stairs, watch the fourth step, and when you go into the bathroom, watch the tiles and smack down. Yes, that's called a public invitee.
That's true.
Good. Hypotheticals are great in this case.
Let's say, you're not selling it. Just it's free. Anybody can take what you want. No, there's no material benefit.
No, but that is for material benefit, right? Material benefit is that you get this junk off your hands.
All right, so that's what I'm just trying to make it sound good.
On the other hand, if you have, and for that matter, if you had not a garage sale, but an antique viewing in your home, a cabinet, right, to show antiques,
okay.
But it was a benefit for the local Girl Scouts, right? It was an event of some kind for some that probably also invite me. But on the other hand, if you just have a bunch of books over to show them your baseball cards, you're not selling baseball cards, you're not trading baseball cards. You just say, hey, wait a minute, are these great or what?
That's cool.
Yeah. So there's really no sense.
It's hard to imagine.
I was trying to imagine what I couldn't think.
Okay. All right.
I think you had a better idea.
Thank you. Yep. Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes. There's no such thing as an asinine policy as far as it goes. The policy is only run the following safety checks. And when you're done with that, you don't have to check.
Probably
not. That's a policy. Then I would suppose, and what's the remedy for that? Once you discover that's the policy, what are you going to do? Are you going to throw the money back? Whoever set that policy will never work. They'll probably have to be in the state. Right?
All right, very good. That was a quick 4-minute break. Okay, so. All right, what is the, that's the first rule. That's one of the two alternative rules in this particular area. The alternative rule, which is called the single standard rule, even though it's actually not anymore, which is exemplified by the Hines case, at least mostly, which involves the same kind of thing, starts out with the line 201, first line of the opinion. The question is whether this court should abolish the common law classifications of licensee, invitee, etc., and accept and require a single duty of reasonable care. Now, that's not the exact rule of Hines. The first case that did this was a California case that's referred to in the text, in the Hines case itself, actually, called Roland v. Christian on page 203, and is actually excerpted in the Hines case. And the Roland v. Christian case said, it's ridiculous to classify people like this, and then to try to figure out what category they fall into. And for that matter, it's ridiculous to say that you owe one kind of duty, level of care, to a trespasser and another to a business invitee. What makes one man's life worth more than another's? And therefore, we reject the classifications and we adopt the rule that when someone comes onto your premises, the duty that you owe is a single reasonable person standard of care to all people who come onto your property,
to maintain the premises in reasonably safe condition, which includes the duty to take reasonable steps to discover dangerous conditions, and once you've discovered them, to take reasonable steps to fix them within a reasonable period of time. And therefore, if that's the rule, then one thing that we know for sure, if that's the rule, what do we know is never going to happen? Practically. What's never going to happen to a case if we adopt the quote-unquote modern single standard rule? This, by the way, has remained the majority rule. This is the minority rule, although it is the modern rule. As the notes after Hines say, the courts first started to follow Rowland in several jurisdictions and then stopped. And the majority of courts continued to use the traditional system of Hardwick-Kinney, the three categories. What's never going to happen in a modern jurisdiction? Yes? Right. What's never going to happen is you'll never have a case dismissed on summary judgment. Because if there's always, there will always be a question, what would a reasonable person have done? What would a reasonable person have done in terms of discovering that broken stair? What would he have done in terms of fixing it? How soon would he have done it? That's going to be a fact-by-fact inquiry in every single case. So you're never going to be able to dismiss cases under this rule. Or very, very rarely. Very, very rarely. Whereas we can easily imagine a case in which a case will be dismissed, if not on summary judgment, on the pleadings. In a social social guest situation, such as the Icy Walk case. Both of these cases, everybody would agree that the Icy Walkway is not a known hidden danger. It's known to the owner, but it's obvious to anybody who comes there that the sidewalk is icy, that there's a pile of ice in front of the door to the hospital. That's obvious. And therefore, since those facts are going to be right there in the pleadings, the defendant is going to come forward and say, excuse me, I didn't have to do anything in this case except avoid this person was a social guest. I can't set traps. But that wasn't a trap. It was an obviously icy walkway in the middle of the winter that I didn't even have to warn. So there isn't any question to be asked of me that can fairly be asked. The only thing you could ask me is, why didn't you put salt on that walkway? Answer, I didn't have to. I had no duty to do more than warn of known hidden dangers. No one is alleging that I didn't do that. And therefore, there's no case. I don't have to go further than that. So I can get that case dismissed very easily. Yes?
What if someone comes over selling something, and once they come inside, decides that
they came to sell me something, they're an invitee, they don't change states. I want you to understand the difference between these two rules. Do you understand the difference that I just explained? Okay? And for that matter, by the way, what if someone trespasses on my property? What if somebody, there was actually a California case like this, that someone was lying on top of a skylight of a building as a trespasser, peering in, trying to figure out how to break in and rob the place. The glass broke, he fell down and seriously injured himself, and then sued. Right? So, obviously over here, I get that case dismissed right away. Right? That's not going anywhere. But in a single standard jurisdiction, was that glass reasonably thick in case someone should happen to climb up there and walk on it? Well, that's a question that has to be answered. And it's not going to be easily dismissible on summary judgment. So in other words, the difference between this jurisdiction and this is that it's almost impossible to avoid lawsuits here for people who are injured on your premises, whereas here it's possible to avoid many more. Okay? Practically speaking, what's the difference between these two? Practically speaking, what's going to happen and what did happen in jurisdictions that adopted the single standard rule? This is one of the reasons that the adoption of that rule stopped dead in its tracks after a certain point in time. What would be the effect of the adoption of that rule? Again, I'm trying to get you to think in terms of policy. what would be a good policy reason to reject the single standard rule and stick to the old rules? In the back row, they're on fire today over there, okay? And everybody else is fat and sleepy from Chinese food. Come on, some of you folks over here. Yes, what's... And what will be the effect of that? In California, what do you think happened after the adoption of the single standard rule? Practically speaking, what happened? Yeah? Okay, what else happened? Yeah, what were you going to say? Is that what you were going to say? What? They didn't pass a statute. No, they did. That's the rule in California. It's also the rule in New York State. Let me ask you something. Did you ever see buildings in New York City once they're abandoned? What happens to those buildings? In the old days, you know what used to happen to an abandoned building? They left it vacant. Everybody, they came in and they tore all the copper out of there and the pipes and the toilets and everything else. In fact, that's how you redeveloped the building. First, you just opened the doors, and then you let everybody come in and rip all the stuff they wanted out of there. And then eventually, you know, when it was ripped clean and you'd avoided all those demolition costs, you built your new building. But that doesn't happen anymore. As soon as you see a building abandoned in New York City, what else do you see happen to that building? Yes?
They board it up.
And they don't just board it up, because boarding it up isn't enough in New York. They brick it up. And then they paint nice little rose, you know, and little curtains and windows and pots on the bricks so it looks like not so ugly. Why do they do that? Why don't they just leave the stupid thing open? Is it because they're worried about, you know, the elements are going to damage the abandoned bricks inside? No. It's because trespassers will come into those buildings and sleep there and get hurt there and sue your pants off. And therefore, you have to take reasonable steps to keep the trespassers out, because you're going to be held liable. You're going to have to defend yourself anyway if they get in and they get injured. And that's not just going to... Forget about the cost of insurance. What does that do to the cost of developing real estate? It makes it very expensive. You have to have walls and razor wire and everything, even on an abandoned or partially developed building, because otherwise you may be asking for lawsuits. So the cost of housing and real estate development, both commercial and residential, escalates, you would expect it anyway, to escalate drastically if you adopt the single standard rule. That's one reason, for example, that the Hines Court doesn't do that. Because the Hines Court is sort of a compromise between these two rules. What is the Hines rule? What's the difference between the Hines rule and either of these rules? Did you catch it? Yeah? Yes? What's the difference?
The difference is that it's not single, really. It's really double, because they distinguish a combined invitee and licensee and left out.
Well, they didn't leave it out.
Well, I mean, they left it out of the not...
of the reasonable person standard. So Hines is reasonable person standard for invitees and licensees, but the old rule for trespassers. Right? So trespassers aren't going to be able to bring lawsuits in the Hines jurisdiction, but in California, yes, they can, because it's a real single standard rule. So some of the modern courts realized that the consequences could be disastrous of allowing trespasser lawsuits, and so they excised that, but not all of them, and in some of them it is genuinely a single standard rule. But there's another reason, isn't there, for courts preferring... By the way, what would be the alternative? Why would you say that... No. We want a single standard rule, even if it's going to allow, and I mean a real single standard, including trespassers, even if there's going to be more lawsuits and higher costs of housing and insurance and everything else. Why would you nevertheless want a higher standard for everyone across the board? What's the answer to that? Yeah?
Protect children.
Protect children?
Sure. Keep kids from getting in there.
But this doesn't protect only kids. This protects everybody. As a matter of fact, every jurisdiction has, as you see on page, hang on a second here. Where do we see that? On page 200, note 8, a separate rule for child trespassers. The separate rule for child trespassers is actually more demanding than the rule for invitees. You have to treat kids, even if they're trespassers, you have to be careful to know that they might be coming and that your property might attract them, and therefore you have to take measures to protect them at all costs. You don't need the single standard rule to do that. Every jurisdiction follows a child trespasser rule. It's also known as the attractive nuisance doctrine. If you have, for example, in Arizona, where I used to live, no, everybody has a swimming pool and everybody has a gate. And everybody has swimming pool covers if they go away for an extended vacation. Why? Because an empty swimming pool is an attractive nuisance. In other words, it's an attraction to kids, and it's dangerous to them, and therefore you have to take extra measures to make sure that kids don't get in there. You, one case that we've looked at before is mentioned in the... Yeah? Huh? No, not Pecora. But it's similar. The railroad turntable case. Cranial. It's an attractive nuisance. It's like an empty swimming pool. Or a full swimming pool, for that matter. So the child trespasser is not the reason for this. But why should you want to allow all these lawsuits? What would be the reason? Yeah? Yeah, to avoid accidents and make sure that every human being who gets injured has compensation, right? So in other words, if we place the deterrence value, make sure that buildings are not left in conditions in which people get injured. We don't care if it's costly, do it. And if they do get injured, you'll have to pay. Unless, of course, there was no negligence. And we're not saying here you're automatically negligent. It's not a strict liability rule. But you're going to have to explain why you didn't make it safer. So that policy we can understand. But even though it's going to increase costs. However, what could you say is a policy, another policy, underlying the decision of most jurisdictions to say, no, we're not going there. We're not going there because there's something else that's more important than safety or accident prevention and compensation, which would be better guaranteed by this rule. This is another example of how rules are surrogates for policies or goals. So one policy could be accident prevention and compensation. This rule is better. This rule is better at holding down costs in a vital sector of the economy, real estate development. We see how vital it is, because right now we don't have it and we're dying. But is there another? So that's a kind of, again, that's a very tough argument to make often. We prefer cheap real estate to human life. That's basically the argument. We prefer cheap housing, right, to human life and suffering. That's kind of a tough statement to make. Is there anything else that would explain the preference, and is the majority preference, for the traditional rules? Mr. Andy?
It's a little hard to digest that you have to protect trespassers.
It's a little hard to digest. That's a wonderfully clear, articulate policy statement, Mr. Andy. You're going to win a lot of cases on that basis. What's the policy? That's called the not throwing up policy. That's called the anti-vomit policy.
Why are we protecting people who are breaking the law?
They're cold. They're poor. They're homeless. We're protecting them because they're human beings. You know what I mean? Milk of human kindness in your veins? Just money? That's all you care about?
No, if someone's sleeping around my backyard and trips on a tree roof, why should they be allowed to sue me?
Why are you... Well, because he's a human being. Why? He doesn't have to... By the way, you may not have to pay him. Right? You just have to answer, why didn't you fix that tree root? Or why didn't you put a fence around the tree? Or why didn't you put a fence around your property? Why shouldn't you have to answer those questions, Mr. Indick? Why shouldn't you? We're not saying you're going to have to pay him. All we're saying is you have to answer questions. Because he's a human being. And we all have responsibilities to each other as human beings. Right? Wrong. Wrong. When don't we, or why might we say sometimes, no. We don't have responsibilities always, because why? We've already talked about this. I'm asking you to think in terms of what we previously talked about. Yeah?
The economy, just the right of the possessor and landowner to do what they want with their property.
Right. Or as we used to say, before sexism taught us otherwise, a man's home is his castle. I have to, come on, this is my home. This is my private space. If you come into it, then, you know, against my will, without my knowledge, and without my permission, then you're intruding on me. You're actually damaging me. If you get hurt in the process, it's your tough luck. Why? Because to compensate you, to allow you to sue me, would be to allow the state to step in and violate my autonomy. If I have to have some place where I don't have to clean up my act for anybody. Otherwise, you know, I have to shave before I go to bed. What's the point of... Well, I don't really do that, but, you know, theoretically, what's the point? So, yes, the autonomy interest helps to explain why the traditional categories make more sense. Wait a minute. Okay, I understand. Trespassers? I understand. You know, they're violating, it would be violating my autonomy. I don't even want the guy there. I didn't know he's there. What responsibility do I have? None. But what about a licensee? What about a licensee? How does the autonomy interest explain not just one of these three categories, but all three? Yeah?
For a licensee, it's almost like I'm inviting you over as a social guest. So why should I have to do anything that I wouldn't do to myself?
Yes, yes, exactly. As a matter of fact, that's the way the courts talk about it, right? That's the way the court talks about it in Carter, excuse me, in Carter v. Kinney. That the whole idea of this doctrine is that if you are a licensee, the principle is that the social guest takes the premises as he finds them. Why is that? Love me, love my dog, you know? Come to my house.
So, you know, you live, then we're friends, right? If we're friends, then if I live with dirty socks on the floor, so you should also like it, you know? If I have my pizza for last week, what's the big deal? We're friends, right? So a social guest really doesn't have any claim on me. Yes, I'm opening up my house to you on the same terms that I live in it. And that's, again, I am limiting my autonomy. But why? Because I have to warn you of things that I know about and you don't. I have to put you on an equal footing with me. That's basically the idea of a social guest. We're on an equal footing. If I know something's wrong, you're going to know it. If I know that it's wrong and it's not obvious to you. If I don't know that it's wrong, you also won't know that it's wrong. So what? Even Stephen. We are equals in each other's homes. So my autonomy is still protected, meaning you don't have a right to demand more of me than I demand of myself. I live to a certain standard of self-protection. It's the standard that you get to. On the other hand, when I come to an invitee, and that's someone I'm inviting in like a stranger, an arm's length relationship for my benefit, then, in effect, I can't claim any defense because I've made my home a public place. It's like I've turned my home into a store. I've turned my home into an office. I've turned my home into a place of business. And if that's the case, then I have to conduct myself as a reasonable person in every respect and make my premises safe for you. And there's no violation of my autonomy by asking me to do that. So therefore, those rules make sense in terms of protecting the autonomy value, least where autonomy is not deserved, most where it's deserved most of all, and in the middle where it's deserved but only to a certain extent. Is there any other reason that would justify this? We've got two policies now. And by the way, that policy, the autonomy policy, always has a lot of power in our culture because we value autonomy to such a degree. At least traditionally, our political culture has valued it to such a degree. So now we're no longer saying, you know, we care more about cheap housing than human life. We're saying we care more about personal autonomy than we do about protection and compensation. We've already said that before in the no-feasance, no-duty argument, so it's nothing new. What other policy might justify the traditional rules besides cheap housing, aggregate economic effect, and besides autonomy? Yeah?
I guess
going to
the Castro rule.
The Castro rule! Very good, Mr. Castro. You see how brilliant you were? You didn't know. Yeah, explain it to Mr. Castro. He doesn't know.
Like
in buying my, if I have a social guest over, I'm not going to check every corner to see if I...
You better. You better. If you live in California, you better. And therefore, if this is the rule, what will you do? Just like in the social host situation. What will you do? No more parties. Right. Forget about alcohol. Forget about no more parties with alcohol. No more parties at all. Because come on, I don't want to have to go through my house with a home inspector every time I have a party. I don't want to have to go through the place as though the in-laws were coming. Right? I'm learning about what that's like. I don't want to have to clean up everything and check the upstairs bathroom and the downstairs bathroom and everything else because a bunch of schlubs are coming over who are my friends. And therefore, if that's what I have to do, let's just go out to a bar. Let's just go hang out in a park. So in other words, we lose the sociability value, right? We lose the value of intimate, casual, home-based social relations that would be protected under the licensee rule. Under the licensee rule, I don't have to worry about that when I have a party, because whatever the house is like, whatever I know about it, I make a list. You get it? You walk in the door, I hand you a piece of paper. Watch the bathroom door, watch the closet, watch the... You get a card. That's it. Okay? And it's easy. I know what's wrong. I write it down. But I don't have to do anything about it, right? So I can still have a party. Whether I can serve alcohol, I can do that too because of the no duty to social host rule. So there is another policy, and that policy, lest you think I'm making this up, let's look at the language just before the end of the Carter v. Kinney opinion on the bottom of page 197. Next to last paragraph of the opinion. Mr. Carter says that human intercourse and the intangible benefits of sharing one's property with others for a mutual purpose are hallmarks of a licensee's permission to enter. And therefore, the court says, he thinks he's winning his argument at that point. That's the whole point of a licensee rule. That we want to support and permit and encourage, and or at least not discourage, human social intercourse and the intangible benefits of sharing our homes with each other. What is that? That's the Castro rule. That's the rule that there's a difference between meeting people in a bar or going to the movies and having folks over at the house. There's a big difference. And you could call it the friendship value. You could call it the civility value. You could call it the social relations value. Whatever you want to call it, we call it the Castro rule. The policy is the same. If we are going to make a rule that turns our homes into places of business for everybody, then we will no longer have friends. We will just have colleagues or business relationships. That's a terrible thing to have, particularly in a society that is already pretty thin in the friendship area, as many sociologists have pointed out for the last 40 years. And therefore, most jurisdictions... So, therefore, we see that in the comment after Hines v. Webster on page 208, which is talking about the ultimate rejection by most courts of the single standard modern rule, or even the double standard. Invitees and licensees, full duty of care, but trespassers not. Even that rule has been rejected by the majority of jurisdictions. Why? Prosser and Keaton, this is the Horn book that I recommended to you some time ago. Anybody ever look at it? Prosser and Keaton say that this movement to the modern rule stopped. Why? Because there was a dissatisfaction with the blind subordination of other legitimate social objectives to the goals of accident prevention and compensation. That's exactly what we've been talking about. What are the other legitimate social objectives that are served by sticking with the old rules here instead of going to the new rule? Answer, at least three. Avoiding negative economic impacts on the housing industry and property development. Number two, avoiding the dilution of personal autonomy that comes with a more intrusive rule that extends itself into our own homes. And number three, reducing the sphere of private, friendly social relations that can be conducted without fear of lawsuits. Under the single standard rule, every time you have a guest in your house, that guest is a potential plaintiff in a lawsuit against you. That's the hard, cold truth. Every time you have somebody over under the single standard rule, you're inviting a lawsuit. Now, that's likely to put a damper, as it were, on having folks over just to have a nice time. So the rejection of that is quite interesting because it shows that even in tort law, there is something that we care about more than accident prevention and compensation. And this particular, not no duty, but limited duty rule shows that that is the case. Now, practically speaking, just so we understand clearly, we said that the effect of a no-duty rule is to say no questions. That's not the effect of this rule. The effect of this rule is to say you can only ask certain questions, but not others. So if you invited the invitee, if you had your boss over, your accountant, then that accountant's lawyer is allowed to ask you, did you know that the stairs were broken? No. Why didn't you know? What was the last time you had inspected them? When was the last time you had somebody over to go through the house? If your answer is yes, I did, why didn't you fix it? How expensive would it have been? Why didn't you get to it as soon as you found out? What else was going on in your life? In other words, all the questions can be asked here and here. But if it's a social guest, the only questions that can be asked are, did you know the stairway was broken? Answer, no. That's the end. It's the only question I have to answer. Because if that's true, it wasn't a known danger. Right? Or if I say, did you know the stair was broken? Yes. Well, why didn't you tell my client about it? It was obvious. There was no tread on the stair. You had to jump from the third step to the fifth step. Now, that may be a terrible thing to leave your house in such a condition, but nobody but an idiot wouldn't see that there's no step there. Right? So, yeah, I knew about it, but so did he. Right? So I didn't even have to say, watch out for the empty step. Right? End of questioning. There was no step there. Everybody could see that. Oh, did you know that it was broken? Yes. Was it obvious? No. So why didn't you fix it? Because I told him, watch out for step number four. I warned him. End of case. Right? So the case with the licensee limits my duty and limits the questions and protects my privacy and protects social relations and reduces the number of lawsuits or increases the number that can be easily thrown out and therefore keeps housing costs down. That's a pretty good policy basis for the old rules. Nevertheless, many jurisdictions say, not good enough. We owe each other a greater duty than that. Even when we are friends, we want to protect each other against each other and avoid accidents and compensate injuries. Okay, so that is our... How many is that now? Which rule was that? That was our fifth no-duty rule. Even though it's not a no-duty rule, it's a limited duty rule, but it only applies, again, don't try to apply this in situations that involve injuries to people off premises, right? It's only where we are dealing with an injury on the premises due to a condition, a defective condition of the premises. Okay, for next time, next Tuesday, we will go to our last no-duty rule. Just to give you a little bit of a heads up on it, it's a little bit odd because it doesn't come across as a no-duty rule. It comes across instead, and this is the cases on emotional distress damages, beginning really on page 264. I've given you additional reading, a short reading on page 698 to introduce you to the fact that this next no-duty rule is a combination discussion of the duty requirement and a damages issue in a torts case. Okay? So it's both duty and damages. Damages is the last issue of the plaintiff's case. We haven't discussed it before. And the separate case will introduce you to that. And then we will talk about the emotional harm cases, beginning with Falzoni. There's a bunch of reading to do for next time, and it's a little complicated. So read it. This is another area where there are multiple rules, different rules in different jurisdictions. Okay? See you next time. If there's food in the back still, bring it down and let's throw all this stuff out, okay?